This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices, sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, Father Ian's Playing with Food, where he sits in on a caramel making session with Erin Holden, owner of Queen Bee Caramels.
It's thickening up quite well.
Yeah, it gets thicker, gets lower in the pan, don't really have to be stirring it. Wait.
Then KCBX programming intern Sam Doyle Jacobson speaks with Kim Bishop and her musician son Wes about the nonprofit San Luis Obispo Instrumental Music Boosters Association, or SLOIMBA, and how it's changed student lives in SLO.
I've just developed the skills and met people through this that have been so meaningful to me that I can make this my full-time passion.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, March 31st, 2025. I'm Meher Ali. Let's start with an interview. Marisa Waddell, KCBX's programming director, is in conversation with Ira Glass, the creator, producer, and host of This American Life. You can hear it every Sunday morning from 11 to noon on KCBX. Ira is touring with a show called An Evening with Ira Glass, Seven Things I've Learned, and he's coming to the San Luis Obispo Performing Arts Center this coming Saturday, April 5th at 8 o'clock.
Welcome, Ira.
Nice to be here.
Well, it's good to have you. And now, anytime I've seen you live, it feels very much like an episode of This American Life, but a little different. And it's a bit thrilling to watch you do your craft in person. Talk about the differences between doing a show like this on stage and doing a show on the radio or in a podcast.
Well, one of the things that I try to do when I do the shows is that I come with sound and music and scoring and stuff. So basically, I'm recreating the sound of the radio show live on stage in front of the audience. So I'm telling stories, but you know, there's quotes and things. So it feels a lot like the radio show. Which I do, like, mostly because when I started giving speeches, like, I didn't know how to give a speech, but I feel like I do know how to be on the radio. So I just tried to, like, recreate the experience for myself on stage. And then, I mean, how is this different from the radio show? I mean, it's different in that I'm there. Like, it just is really different to stand in front of a crowd and talk. And then the show itself is called Seven Things I've Learned, but really it's just an excuse to tell seven really wonderful, kind of funny, great stories.
You've been creating and storytelling and performing since you were a kid. You even studied semiotics in college, which is all about communication and meaning. Do you know what it is about storytelling and the communication of meaning that attracted you and has attracted you ongoing for the rest of your life?
I mean, it's funny. Like, I don't have, like, a high-minded answer to that. Like, It just seemed really fun to be on the radio and tell a story. And then it just became really interesting, the problem of how do you make something that's so compelling that people, if they're listening to the, like, the first few seconds of it, they cannot help themselves but listen to the next and the next and the next. Like, just that problem just became really kind of fun and interesting and continues to.
Can I?
I saw this quote recently by this novelist named Michael Cunningham, and he said this thing where I feel like, oh, I didn't think that, but as soon as he said it, I feel like that is exactly what I feel. And he said that he doesn't believe in talent. He says he thinks what happens is, this is like a Pulitzer Prize winning novelist. He wrote The Hours and he's written a lot of great stuff. And he said, I don't believe in talent. He says, what I believe is there's a certain kind of person who gets a kind of obsessive interest in the question, how do I make this better? And that's what leads to things being good. And I feel like, oh, that is exactly like my experience of working on the radio. I feel like when I started, like, I really was not very good. Like, one of the things I do in this talk is I play a story that I did 8 years into working in radio, and it's just terrible. But I really was just, I don't know, I just enjoyed making stuff, and I like enjoyed the problem of how do you make it better.
Yeah, it seems like over time you've developed a formula for storytelling that captivates people and has won you several awards, like 7 Peabodys and a Pulitzer and more. I remember picking up your comic book in the early 2000s about how to make great radio and being impressed by how you distilled what you do into about 30 pages, illustrated pages. And I know it takes a whole show or a comic book to explain, but can you touch on that formula and talk about how you came up with it over time?
I mean, I came up with it really through trial and error, and also through like a book or two that I read in college. And really a lot of it just comes down to like a story at its most basic is literally just a sequence of like, this thing happened and that led to this next thing and that led to this next thing and that led to this next thing. And you know, that isn't the way that most radio journalism is structured. Most radio journalism is structured kind of like a news story where you say like, here's the thing that happened today. And, you know, here are the facts about it, you know, and then here's what the people who it happened to say, and here's what the people who perpetrated say, and you sort of give all sides of the thing. You don't present the kind of like, here's the order, here's the story in the order that it happened. This led to this, led to this, led to this, led to this. But that's a traditional story. And so a lot of what we're doing is conducting interviews and structuring stories. So they just adhere to kind of the oldest form of what a story can be, where you're just kind of starting at the beginning and saying this happened and this happened and this happened. And then periodically for radio, I think you have to jump out of the plot and periodically just talk about like, so what do we make of this? You know, what does this mean? What does this make us feel? What does this make us think? What does it show us that we didn't know before? And really on our show, we just go back and forth between those two things, the forward motion and the ideas. And you know, saying that, it sounds like, okay, it's a formula, but like I have to say, it's so simple. It gives you a thing to structure around. And it's just very helpful to have that picture in your head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that gets back to the semiotics part of it, the meaning behind what we're hearing.
Semiotics is what I studied in college. It's an incredibly pretentious body of like literary theory. And like there was one book in particular that I read by a writer named Roland Barthes, a French writer, called S/Z that I picked up recently, and I found it like nearly unreadable. But at the time, like I was so inside the world of this theory that I really did. It really did. I mean, to say it changed my life, it really did, it's the book that changed my life. Because what he does is that he breaks down a short story. There's like a really good like little short piece of fiction that's printed in the back that's like 30 pages long. And what he does in this book is that he breaks it down kind of phrase by phrase and paragraph by paragraph. And what he's interested in is not the kind of like the thing that like your English teacher was interested in, is like, what are the themes of the book? And what does it say about the author? What does it say about the others? He has no interest in that. What he's interested in is, how does a story give pleasure? Like he's like, you know, at the end of like a really great short story, a really great episode of TV, a really great movie, you have that feeling of like, ah, that was so good. He's like, how do you produce that? What's the machinery? And then he takes apart this short story and he says there are five different pieces of like sort of machinery in this story, five different things that happen in making a story that give that. And he kind of outlines them. And when I was a student in college, I had already been working at NPR when I was in college. I started NPR when I was 19. I read that and I was like, oh, this is what I'm going to use to make radio stories. And so I started to use some of his principles. Like one of the things he talks about is this thing that he calls the pro-eretic code. He says it's sort of, if you have any sequence of actions, like the kind of sequence I'm talking about, where like one thing leads to the next, he says no matter how banal it is, no matter how everyday it is, you automatically create the question, like, what's going to happen next? Where is this leading to? And he says that question hangs in the air and people will stick around to hear like, where are you going with this, in a way that creates narrative suspense and makes people kind of like hold on to the thing. And for me, as like a young person trying to make stuff, that was just a very useful hint of how to make stories about everyday life, which is the thing I wanted to do. And because it said like, you could just have very everyday stuff, but as long as like one thing is leading to the next, the listener wonders like, where are we going? And we'll stick around. And it was like a tool to kind of like hold people's interest and create narrative suspense. So that kind of thing is the sort of thing that I was thinking about when I came up with this way of making stories.
Yeah. And you've been doing that and fascinated with that your whole life, it seems to me.
Yes.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Marisa Waddell, and I'm talking with the creator, producer, and host of This American Life, Ira Glass, who's coming to the San Luis Obispo Performing Arts Center this coming Saturday, April 5th at 8 o'clock. Ira, you seem also to be on a mission to get other people to create great radio too. You even have a section on your website called Make Radio. What Yes. makes you want to encourage others in this way?
I don't know. It's fun. Like, I don't have anything being high-minded about it. I just think there's a certain kind of person for whom this would be fun. And I also think that there's like a kind of person who hears the stuff that we do in our show and that they do on other shows like ours and just thinks, like, I could do that. And I would say, like, if you're hearing my voice right now and you're thinking that, chances are you probably could. Like, it's not that complicated. And, like, as you were saying, like, you know, like, we put out this comic book, which, like, kind of lays out the principles. There's also a website called Transom, TRANSOM.org, which has, like, a ton of stuff for anybody who thinks that they might want to try something like that. They actually have, like, seminars and retreats where they say to people, like, okay, you are not in radio, but you think maybe this would be something for you. In 6 weeks, we will train you. Come to Massachusetts and we will, like, put you up and train you.
Yeah, and now everybody has a podcast, but they're not all good.
It is really true that everybody has a podcast. I have to say, when Obama and Springsteen started a podcast, I was like, does everyone in the world have to do their job and my job too?
Well, and the thing is, you know, like I said, they're not all good. You did an episode where the parents of the folks who are staff on This American Life came up with things to tell stories about. And
yes,
and they were not that great at picking good stories to talk about.
No, that was a story. Yeah, that was a show we called Stories Our Parents Pitch. And it really came out of our real life experiences where all of our parents would say, like, why don't you do a story about this? And then the stories are always like, I remember my dad was like, I sat next to a guy on a train and he was in World War II. I was like, yeah, that's all he had. He was like one of the, like, you know, 30 million people in World War II. Anyway, so yeah, so they weren't the greatest pitches.
So what is it about identifying a story that's worth telling and that you think will be interesting for other people to listen to?
I mean, the first thing is it just has to be surprising. It just has to be something you haven't heard before. That really carries a lot of it. And then some stories, just kind of the world of the story, is just like a pleasing world to think about. You know, like, people who make movies apparently talk about this a lot. Like, what's the world of the film? Is it a world you kind of want to hang out in? And then some people are just really great at talking about their own lives. And for radio, for a story, I think, to be really great, like, the person at the center of the story, like, has to be the kind of talker where they're actually honest about their feelings and is in touch with their feelings. Often, like, so much of the time, we'll have a lead on a story that we think will be a great story, and then we go to do the interview, and the person just, like, is just not, like, in touch with their feelings about the story, and we can't use it for radio. Because, like, it's just not compelling enough to hear them walk through it. So those are the things we're looking for.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you work way ahead of time before broadcast on an episode, like, months ahead of time, right?
I mean, generally, there'll be one story that we've been working on for months, mm-hmm. and then everything else in the show we'll throw together in the last 3 weeks.
That sounds kind of scary, but thrilling.
That's normal broadcasting. What are you talking about? That's the normal world of being a broadcaster.
Yeah, I know. But it is scary and thrilling at the same time, isn't it?
I, the thrilling part I'm not as in touch with. The scary part I'm very in touch with.
Well, you did say it's fun, too.
It's fun and it's also horrible. Like it's like a, you know, like, I'm glad I have a job I like. So many people don't. And I really never lose sight of that. But, like, anything you end up spending a lot of hours doing, like, it, like, you know, there's good days and there's hard days.
The technology behind audio storytelling has changed a lot since you first started doing This American Life. And now public radio is having to figure out how to keep doing what it's good at on other platforms. And it's also in the crosshairs of the current administration. What do you think is the future of public radio in the U.S.?
I mean, that's not something I feel like a big expert on. I think radio will always be here because, I for a bunch of reasons. One is, as long as, like, people have cars, it's just a little bit of a pain in the ass to program all your listening for yourself. But when I think about, like, public radio's role, you know, I think that there is still a place for independent media that is created without the primary goal of making money for the people who create it. You know, so I just believe in a corny, idealistic way that there'll continue to be a market for that.
It needs funding.
It does need funding. Yeah.
Because it's not inexpensive to produce good audio storytelling.
Right. Though I will say, like, you know, the federal money that goes to most public radio stations is only 5 to 10% of their budgets.
Yeah. And KCBX, it's about 12%.
Okay. And so if they were to lose, so if most stations were to lose that money, it would be a big hit. Mm-hmm. And definitely we would all feel it on the air. And also, like, shows like ours, which began with federal money, like, it wasn't the first funding we got, but like in year 2, 3, and 4 of our show, we did get some federal money, which really was instrumental in a national show like ours being able to continue and survive and get to the point where we never needed any money from, you know, any federal agency or anybody. All of that would be lost. But I do think public radio would continue and could be strong.
Yeah, I agree. And it's partly because, you know, the people who listen to what we do love it so much. I mean, this is one of the very few nonprofit organizations where people just give and give and give. And I think it's because it's so meaningful and touches them in a deep part of their heart and soul and psyche.
Yes. And I feel like I'm being very, like, positive in my answers to you. But the fact is that, like, all radio listening is down.
Yeah.
Including for public radio. And even, like, one of the prime places where people were listening to radio, which was in the car. Like, now when you get into a car, you have to push, like, 4 different buttons to even find the radio. And so the whole model for using this technology, that's threatened. I still think that there's just something you can do on radio, which is different. There's just an intimacy to radio that gives the stories a different feeling. Like, we're doing a story that I was just working on right before I sat down with you that is going to be on a show coming up very, very quickly about somebody who was in the news. There was newspaper articles, TV stories about this person named Ranjini. I can't remember her last name. She's basically a student at Columbia who, before Mahmoud Khalil was arrested, like, she found herself in the crosshairs of, like, being thrown out of the country. And, you know, there were stories about her, but having her on the radio to tell the story from the beginning and hearing it in her own voice and hearing step by step in detail, like, what she went through, and also hearing, like, what's different in U.S. policy. She's somebody who's very much like a rule follower, was very careful that her visa was always up to date, knew all the rules. One of the things that happened when ICE came knocking on her door, she had gotten a letter saying that her student visa had been revoked. And the fact is, like, your student visa is sort of like your ticket into the country. But once you're in the country, as long as you're still enrolled in school, you're not in violation of any law. You just have to reapply for the visa if you want to reenter the U.S. And so really, like, she could stay in the country. As long as she was a student, she was in legal status in the United States. And even if Columbia had kicked her out of school, she would have 15 days to leave the country. And so for her student visa to be revoked and for ICE to show up on the first day to kick her out, it wasn't following the rules. Like, it didn't make any sense. And just, like, noting what is different in what is happening. And then the rationale that ICE finally gave for it also, like, to be able to get into the details of it and hear a person talking about it and who can say, okay, this happened to me, here's the facts. I think it just plays differently with the intimacy of radio. And the fact that on public radio, we can let the story live at its proper length. I mean, that story is probably going to be 25 minutes long in our show. You know, think about, like, where is anything 25 minutes long in the world of TV news, in the world of TikTok, in the world of, like, nothing runs for 25 minutes long. You know, like, one of the things we know is that people who listen to our show and other shows really do stick around for stories of that length. Like, it's a place where I think because it's radio and because of the kind of storytelling it is, you know, this truism of Americans don't have attention spans anymore because of our phones, I feel like you see the lie to that. Like, people really do stick around for for not just, you know, 25-minute story, but for these long series that we make, you know, or the serial or the spinoff company makes, you know, where like, you know, it'll be a 9-episode, 9-hour show and people will stick around the way they would stick around for like a TV show they're binging. Mm-hmm. And so I just feel like there's like a power to this medium that gives something that you can't always get elsewhere.
I wrote one last question. What gives you hope these days?
I don't know. Am I required to have hope these days? Like, I don't know. Like, I'm by nature kind of a hopeful person. And so, like, I do tend to think, like, oh, things will work out for the best. But I feel like we're in, like, a particular historic moment where there are enormous changes. And we all have to kind of see how it's going to shake out. Like, I feel like my role and the role of our show now is to document accurately this unusual moment that we're all in.
Well, thanks for being with me this afternoon, Ira.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm sorry I didn't have a more hopeful message for the end.
That's okay. That's one of the reasons why we listen to you, is we listen to you for the truth. Thanks for taking the time to talk with me.
Thanks for the questions.
My guest has been Ira Glass, the creator, producer, and host of This American Life, which you can hear every Sunday morning from 11 to noon on KCBX. Ira is coming to the San Luis Obispo Performing Arts Center this coming Saturday, April 5th at 8 o'clock. Tickets are at calpolyarts.org. For Issues and Ideas, I'm Marisa Waddell.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Next, Father Ian is playing with food, and specifically handmade caramel.
The sweet sound of the San Luis Obispo local band Soul Maps is the perfect backdrop to talk about the sweet taste of caramels. These aren't those plastic-tasting national brand cubes. These are handmade caramels with local honey prepared in a kitchen of a nurse and a mom of two kids in Atascadero. I discovered these caramels at a food and drink event, and I needed to know more, so I invited myself into Aaron's kitchen to learn all about honey caramels.
Aaron Holden, I'm the owner of Queen Bee Caramels.
Where did the name come from?
So I'm a beekeeper and I use honey from my own beehives in all the recipes. So kind of a play on being the queen bee of my life.
How long have you been doing this?
This would be 3 years this June. Yeah, 3 years this June. But I've been a beekeeper for 10 years. So
I'd imagine that the honey gives it, these are kind of unique caramels, not kind of like your Brocks.
Yeah, you can Google and find honey caramels throughout the country, but there aren't many in California that I've ever found. So it was, kind of a fun twist. And I had excess of honey that I needed to do something with.
How many bees do you have?
Right now, I still have 7 hives that have made it through the winter, and I've had upwards of 10 at a time.
Wow. And do you sell your honey?
Not anymore, because it needs to all go into the recipes.
Oh,
yeah.
You make that many caramels?
Yeah, I do have some honey, like still from last year that we're finishing up. But yeah, I do make that many caramels.
We're here in your house. So my question for you is, are you cottage?
Yes. So I have a cottage industry license and renew that every year and allows me to work out of my home kitchen. In the state of California and other states, you can get a cottage industry license, which allows you to cook out of your home kitchen. And different counties have different regulations. And then the county comes and does an inspection of my kitchen once a year and makes sure I'm following all the regulations and my fridge is the right temperature and proper sanitary practices. And then, lets me cook out of my home kitchen.
Are you going to make caramels for me today?
Yes. Yep. Getting ready and I've got orders that came through, and so gotta get rolling.
Okay, let's go.
Okay.
What are the ingredients that we have here to make caramels?
While I still am using my own honey, I still have to use a granulated sugar, and then heavy whipping cream, butter, and still a little bit of corn syrup. The honey that my bees produce is really dark, and it almost has a bitter flavor to it, so kind of cut that a little bit with some corn syrup as well. And then depending on the flavors, go from there. They all pretty much have an equal base recipe, and then change it up based on the flavors.
In this corn syrup jug, is that your honey?
Yes. I always have leftover jugs of corn syrup, and they are the perfect container to store honey in because it's easy to pour out of. I used to just keep them in 5-gallon buckets, and then it's like really difficult to pour, only 6 ounces of honey out of a 5-gallon bucket, obviously, because it's extremely heavy. I do them by pan. So I've got 2 different size silicone pans that they're going to be poured into. One I just call a large batch, one I call a half batch. So the smaller pans make my half batch, and then we're going to use a bigger pot to make a double batch.
Do you do this every single day?
Not this season. So some seasons I am. So obviously going into Christmas and just depending on how many orders come in. Right now, I think I've got 3 or 4 clients that ordered because I sell throughout the county. So I'm making their orders. And then I've got 2 events next weekend that I'm making caramels for.
You put these 4 ingredients, right? Sugar, well, 3 types of sugar and 2 types of dairy fat.
Yep.
That's why I like them so much. What's the process?
So for me, it's super easy. I just measure all my ingredients out and put them on the stove, stir a little bit, get them to the right temperature, which is going to be around 250 degrees, pour them in the pans and let them cool, and then cut and wrap them. So a lot of people are like, oh man, it must be so intense. You're standing over the stove stirring nonstop. I'm like, no, not really. I'm only stirring in the beginning so that the sugar mixes in and it gets cohesive. And then I'm done stirring until I pour it out.
That sounds pretty simple. And what got you started on this?
So during the pandemic, my mom had bought me like one of those Alexas that has the video screen, you know, so you could stay in touch with family and have like face-to-face conversations with people. But it would also pop up all these different recipes. And one day it showed a recipe for a bourbon black pepper caramel. I'm like, all right, I'll make that. I like to bake. I like to cook. I've worked at a bakery before. And so I made it and it was tasty. I'm like, oh, I wonder if I could like develop a honey-based caramel recipe. So I kind of looked up ideas for what the ratios could be and kind of developed a recipe. Started playing with tons of different flavors, took them to work. People loved them. I've always wanted to have my own little business and side gig and just went down the rabbit hole.
Took them to work. Are you still in that job or is this supporting your family?
Yeah, no, I am a full-time ER nurse.
Oh.
And so, yeah, I do that full-time, 3 12-hour shifts, and then fit in caramels where I can.
Wow. Okay. Full-time ER nurse. And kids?
And kids, yeah. A 5-year-old and an almost 8-year-old. So there's always a lot going on that makes it hard to fully pay attention to the caramels.
Okay. So this first one is starting to bubble a little bit.
Yes. And we're going to add the thermometer sooner than later because we don't want it to be done before we've got a thermometer into it and make sure we pull it at the right temperature.
What are some of your greatest mistakes?
Flavors, for sure. Sometimes flavors haven't worked out. Like, I finally got matcha down, but if you add too much matcha or not the right quality of matcha, it just tastes like you're eating a handful of dirt. So that's no good. And then I've definitely overcooked and I've definitely undercooked. And probably in 2.5 years, I've probably only had to throw out like 4 batches. A little painful, but...
So this one's really bubbling. Oh, you've got a third batch going on.
Oh yeah. Oh. So I'll do as much as 5 at a time. Have I done 6 at a time?
Ooh. This one's really going. This first one's really going. I've made caramels maybe once or twice, mm-hmm. and I would have been reluctant to get it to that big of a boil.
Oh yeah. So I have had them boil over. So this bigger pot cannot go in the smaller pot. This bigger double batch would boil over that small pot for sure. So that I can say I've done probably only twice until I finally was like, stop trying to fit something that doesn't fit.
Do you have any thoughts on caramel versus caramel?
Well, I looked it up because I wanted to be right when I started taking on this business, and I looked it up and it says caramel. So now I adamantly say caramel whenever I can, and there is that extra A, so it's never Carmel. It's not the city, and I don't correct people, but I will say caramel.
I know, I say caramels, knowing that it does have the extra A. I don't know, it's just what I do. Nice thermometer there. The first one that's boiling quite a bit is at 225.
That's the temperature it is. It's going to alarm at 248, but then we're going to pour it at 250.
You're listening to KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, learning how to make caramels on a commercial scale out of a home kitchen. Erin Holden is an ER nurse, wife, and mother of 2, and she's got quite a sweet side hustle with her homemade caramels made with honey from her own beehives. As the caramels bubble on the stove, we talk flavors. You were talking about your different flavors, and I see a big jug of Jim Beam on the counter. Is that for the caramels, or is that for you?
That is definitely for the caramels. I'm going to make bourbon caramels and the churro for that Paso General store order.
How many different flavors do you have?
Always 3. And then once I get into more events, we add 2 more. So there's always honey sea salt, honey bourbon, honey smoked almond. And then not every store carries all of those, but I always offer them and they're always at every market. Coming up in the spring, we'll have honey lavender, and then cherry almond goes kind of throughout the year, but that's not a flavor I'm going to let sell on a shelf because cherry almond, you have to taste it to really know that you like it and then buy it. And then lavender goes away in the fall and we put in pumpkin pie. And then the churros at the Paso General store, and I started making matcha again, which the slow Asian market is going to carry. So they're there as well.
So how do you do the pumpkin spice?
It actually has pureed canned pumpkin goes into the recipe with nutmeg, clove, ginger, and allspice.
And how did you figure out how to make a caramel with like real pumpkin in it?
Just playing around. I kind of know that a small batch, it's pretty good with like 3 ounces of something else in it, especially when it's a wet item, because I obviously have to make sure that it's going to keep cooking. So it did take some time to make sure you also got the right temperature. So just a little bit of playing around and figuring it out. I always have other flavors. So I've got like a wedding that I'm going to help with in April, and they're getting orange cardamom as one of their flavors, which I've made before, which I love. But if you go to events, it just becomes too overwhelming to have more than 5 flavors, especially because we sample everything at every event, and it's just easier to keep it, you know, between 3 to 5 flavors.
It sounds like that your caramels are always kind of fresh.
Yeah, definitely. They do have a good 3-month shelf life, but luckily they do sell out within 3 months at most places. Obviously, the events, people are eating them pretty darn quickly, but I've never had anybody say they got a bag that wasn't good. I'm registered with the county to be able to sell and sample. If I wasn't sampling, then I could just go to the events, but sampling is what makes people love them and want to buy them.
Sampling makes the sale.
Yes, definitely. Especially those different flavors. There's so many people that are like shocked that they love cherry almond. And I make sure some people are like, oh, I definitely don't like cherries anyway. It's then fine. Don't taste it. But a lot of people are like, that is way better than I would have ever thought. And it can be fun to see people's reactions.
Tell me about this cherry almond that you say you either love it or hate it. What made you think of it? And why do you make it if it's so polarized?
So I love watching the Great British Bake Off. And they have a recipe or a dessert called the Bakewell Tart. So it's cherry almond, essentially, in a tart. But then you keep watching season after season and someone's like, oh, I'm going to make a Bakewell Tart cookie. I'm going to make a Bakewell Tart croissant. And use those flavor profiles as the inspiration on the different challenges. So I just was like, oh, I could make a Bakewell Tart caramel. So that's how I came up with that. And I would say it's polarizing really with the cherry flavors. People just, I guess, love or hate cherry, which I wouldn't have thought. It's rarely the almond that people are avoiding.
Interesting.
And now the matcha is becoming very polarizing. We got some very interesting comments from people that probably just don't ever like matcha, don't drink matcha in the first place.
That would be me.
It's a very specific flavor that people will say is dirt-like, but a lot of people in their 20s and 30s really liked it, so.
So I can see that the one we put on first is at 234 degrees, and it's thickening up quite well.
Yep, gets thicker, gets lower in the pan. Don't really have to keep stirring it, just wait, but I do need to measure out the bourbon that's gonna go in that.
And the big one's starting to boil. So how much bourbon goes into a batch?
3 ounces in that smaller batch, 6 in the larger batch. Because it's so much liquid, you have to add it, and then you bring the caramels almost all the way up to that 250 degrees, and then pour in most of the bourbon. But because the bourbon is so wet, if you were to then take it off the stove, you'd just have a super soft, ridiculously soft caramel that you wouldn't even be able to cut. So then you have to heat it back up after adding the bourbon.
And I noticed that you're doing your bourbon by weight.
Yeah, everything by weight, because then I don't have to dirty another measuring cup.
So these look like they were recently packaged, or wrapped, I should say.
Yep, cut and wrapped this week, and then eventually they'll just get bagged and go out to make somebody happy.
Wow, what flavor is this?
Honey sea salt.
How long do they take to cool?
I give them at least 6 hours. Generally, I do it overnight. I'll cook a lot in the morning. My kids get dropped off for school at 9. I don't have to leave for work until 10:30, so I can usually get a batch or however many batches I need to get done before I head into work. So then I don't get home till midnight, so I'm not going to cut and wrap until the next day anyway.
But there's your 250. So that alcohol is evaporating really quickly and some of the water as well, because it's above the boiling point for water.
Yeah, so it steams like crazy. It'll splash all over if I add too much at once. So we just do it slowly, just getting that flavor in there. And then I do leave about like a tablespoon at the very end to add when everything's back up to the right temperature. And then that tablespoon will still burn off alcohol-wise, but still make sure it's got a good bourbon flavor.
So it went down to 213, 250 to 213. Wow.
Yeah, it cools off very quickly. And then we get it heating back up and finalize the rest of the way.
How often do you burn yourself?
Rarely. Luckily, very rarely. I get stung by bees more often than I burn myself with caramels.
Because candy is such a higher temperature than dinner.
Yeah, and this would stick to your skin. It would be a big disaster. It's definitely always in the back of my mind. And I mean, with a cottage industry license, you can't have pets or children in the kitchen when you're doing this anyway. But, you know, if you're going to be making caramels anyway, you probably don't need your children running around the kitchen at all.
So you're looking at the temperature again. Oh,
yep.
There it is.
I'm just going to pull it now. It's at 248. But I'm gonna pull it because it does still tend to heat a little bit more.
And it looks right and yeah. It feels right. I mean, like I said, I've only made caramels once or twice, but to me it looks like it's gonna set into what it's supposed to.
Yeah, super thick and bubbly, and any farther you might be chopping through brittle. Okay, and then the other one's done and needs its bourbon. So we're just gonna turn it off for a second so it doesn't get too hot. Adding the last of the bourbon to the batch that's officially more done.
Ooh,
but
cool.
Still doesn't last too
that's
long.
Cool.
All right, well, now we pour them out.
Okay. Which doesn't make any sound.
No sounds.
You're listening to KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, making caramels in Atascadero. We just poured the bourbon into the hot caramel sauce and watched it violently foam up, and then poured it into a pan to cool and become the delicious, chewy caramels we all love. And now Aaron is going to finish up the churro-flavored caramels.
So you started at about, what, 140, and it's 217.
Yeah, it's pretty fast.
So that's 40 minutes, less
and
than
different
40.
Different pots cook faster than other pots too. So this one is one of my faster pots.
Okay, so this is the big one and you're gonna do?
Churro.
Churro, and so what are the flavors you're gonna put in there?
Just cinnamon. But then, you know, when I first was developing a flavor for the Paso General Store, because they wanted an exclusive flavor, and we kind of went back and forth on different ideas, and I don't remember who said churro, but I was like, well, but all it is a cinnamon caramel. Like, what is gonna make this even stand out from just saying it's cinnamon? And I was saying that to my husband, and he's like, well, why don't you roll it in cinnamon sugar? I'm like, oh, yeah. So once this batch, while it has cinnamon in the caramels, I take them, cut them, and before they're wrapped, they each get hand-dipped in cinnamon sugar. It was a genius moment of his.
Could you use overused fryer oil?
Oh my goodness. Oh, that would be, yeah, they definitely have the fried flavor, wouldn't they?
So quite a bit of cinnamon.
Yeah, 2 tablespoons for this double batch. And this batch will make about 28 bags worth, so approximately 280 individual caramels. And it smells amazing.
How many caramels do you eat a day?
Practically none now. I'm over it. I hardly eat them at all. Maybe if I've developed a new flavor I want to taste, which I don't do very much anymore. My children eat more than me, that's for sure.
And do you do anything special for like family and friends at holidays or something where you might like cover it with chocolate or put nuts in it or whatever?
Well, for my 40th birthday, I made a honey bacon caramel, which would be one I can't sell because of the bacon, but it was pretty amazing. So I did that for my 40th birthday and just handed those out as presents on my birthday.
Was it chopped bacon inside or did you cover a piece of bacon in caramel?
Yeah, chopped, mixed in at the end. So cooked the bacon, chopped it up and added it. And it was different because the fat kind of melted in as well. They were a little bit greasy, but they were very tasty.
Okay, so they're all poured into the pans. Where do they go now?
I got a rack on the other side of the kitchen my husband built me. And so they just go there until they're cooled off. And then I'll get to cutting them in the next day or two. My large tray takes me now about 45 minutes to cut and wrap.
What do you cut it with?
A pizza rocker knife.
Oh, the pizza rocker. Okay, yeah. Cool.
Yeah. So I used to just use my chef's knife, which I then broke one day. But yeah, the pizza cutting knife works perfect and pretty fast. After that, then they're bagged, and each bag is labeled differently depending on the flavor. The colors are a little different per flavor, so they all have their own little personality, and then they go out for consumption.
They all look fairly consistent in size. How do you get the right size?
So it is all by eyeball. So they all are going to be slightly different. They're not going to be exact, but they're close enough where they can still meet weight in the bag and you're not going to get one that's crazy big or crazy small. They're hand done, so they're not going to be commercially exactly the same.
What are they wrapped in?
Wax paper. Took a little bit to learn that, like, oh, just because it looks like it'll be what I need off Amazon, oh, it comes and it's only parchment. It's going to completely stick to the caramel. I know exactly what I'm ordering now. I don't deviate from my order.
So that was fun and fascinating. I wanted to find out what the general public thought, so I went to one of the events and ran into the most enthusiastic taster.
Top notch. Come out and try them. Come on down to Queen Bee Caramels. Sourced from the honey up in Atascadero. Is that how I say it? All right. Come and get them while they're still here. Otherwise, I'm going to buy them all.
So I take it you like them.
I love them.
What flavors did you try?
I think I've tried them all, actually. Yeah.
What was your favorite?
I'm actually very surprised. The matcha caramel, I didn't think that that would work. It was incredible. And then the almond smoked sea salt caramel. Whoa. Wowza.
They're all delicious. They're so delicious.
Have you had them before?
No, I haven't. This is the first time.
Homemade caramels are tasty indeed. Not everyone was as enthusiastic as that first person. Go ahead and try your hand at homemade caramels or pop into the boutique shops of Slo County and pick up a bag of Queen Bee. And remember, it's caramels.
Of course, because I saw her make the bourbon ones.
Okay. Here's a bourbon for you.
Thank you.
May we please have a bag of the honey matcha and then a bag of the honey with smoked almonds and smoked sea salt?
Yes, absolutely.
All right, there's still some left. I can't believe it.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
Up next, Kim Bishop, parent volunteer for the nonprofit San Luis Obispo Instrumental Music Boosters Association, or SLOIMBA, and her son, Wes, a student at Slo High and member of the jazz combo DOM, sit down with Sam Doyle Jacobson, programming intern at KCBX, to talk about the nonprofit's first ever spring fundraiser event called Beats and Brass. It's happening this Saturday, April 5th, from 4 to 8 p.m. at the Rieta Ranch in Santa Margarita. Tickets are on sale at my805tix.com.
Welcome to Issues and Ideas.
Thanks so much for having us, Sam.
Stoked to be here.
So can you give us a brief overview of the local music programs you're involved with, both directly and indirectly?
Well, personally, I am a member of the San Luis Obispo High School Band, mainly the jazz program there. My passion right now is jazz music, and I play jazz piano and saxophone. So I'm involved. Our school has two jazz programs, the stage band and the honors jazz band, and I play saxophone in both. And they're just super valuable to me as a student.
I have to ask, tenor sax or alto sax?
I play tenor.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's super fun. It's really helped me develop my passion for music, and it's given me opportunities to do all kinds of music-related stuff outside of the school. So I got invited into a jazz combo, DOM. We will be playing at the Beats and Brass fundraiser.
Okay.
So there are about 250 kids who are in the band programs at Slo High and Laguna Middle School. And, you know, they're supported by, to a certain extent, the school district. But there's a band boosters organization called SLOIMBA, stands for the San Luis Obispo Instrumental Music Boosters Association. And it's a volunteer, parent-run organization that helps supplement so that students can afford, you know, instruments and repairs and uniforms and going on trips to competitions and parades and festivals and things that really help them develop their musical skills. What I love about SLOIMBA, and I'm a parent volunteer with the organization, what I love about SLOIMBA is that it gives access to quality music education to all of these kids, whether they can afford to study music independently or not. The fact that this education is available through the public schools is pretty incredible, and it's a lot of fun to see what the incredible music teachers can do with kids from a range of backgrounds in such a short time.
So I'm interested in learning more about Slowimba. You mentioned some of the areas that you help students in. Do you have any specific examples or anecdotes from your time with Slowimba?
Sure. Well, mostly Slowimba serves as a booster organization that has a fundraising and, you know, decision-making guidance role. And, you know, the teachers who run the programs are so incredibly busy. I know the one who runs the program at Laguna Middle School also runs the program at Los Osos Middle School. So he's like running back and forth between both programs every day. And the one at the high school, you know, Wes, what are the different programs? There's stage jazz, honors jazz, marching band.
And there's also a symphonic band and wind ensemble, which are more, you know, your classical music stuff.
Yeah, so they've got a lot on their plates. So, you know, as parent volunteers, we mostly help by communicating with families and raising funds. We've got two big fundraisers every year. This year, and in any case, previously it's just been, our big one was selling trees and wreaths around the holiday time. And this year, for the first time, we're adding a spring fundraiser, which we're really excited about. It's called Beats and Brass.
Very cool to hear. Can you quantify how big the music programs are, like how many students are in them?
There are about 250 students total between the high school and the middle school.
Does Slowimba provide support for all of them? Is that your goal?
Yes, exactly. This organization was set up to support both the middle school and the high school in San Luis Obispo.
What are some short-term and long-term goals that Slowimba is working towards?
The big goal is to make sure that students can continue to do things like go to band camp and compete in festivals and competitions and march in parades. You know, band programs are expensive, and the school district has students with lots of interests, and they have to spread themselves around, and things are a little tighter than usual these days. So we mostly raise money for things like bus transportation, for instance. It costs over $1,000 to get all these kids on the bus to go to an event. Instruments, uniforms, repairs, bringing in coaches for band camp, all sorts of things that make it such a quality experience for these kids and also enable them to find community. You know, we hear so much about kids being kind of lost, depressed and anxious, especially in the post-pandemic era. And band provides this incredible community where kids are getting together and doing something together in the real world, playing music together and making these connections and friendships. And it's a big deal. It makes a huge difference, especially for kids from families that can't necessarily afford to find that community or develop those skills outside of the school environment.
That is something that I wanted to ask you, Wes, about your experience with music and what kind of things you've learned from it or what you've enjoyed about it.
Well, I mean, I came into high school. I guess I could say I came into middle school, you know, knowing I liked music and not being super developed in what I liked about it and how I could pursue it. And because of the band program, I've been playing more and more every day. In an average day now, I play 2 hours of music a day in school. I might have a rehearsal for my combo after, or, you know, a rehearsal for some other jazz program. And I've just developed the skills and met people through this that have been so meaningful to me that I can make this my full-time passion that I'm pursuing in high school. Right now, my combo, DOM, is my job, which is so fun. We get gigs, you know, around town, and it's just such a cool experience being able to do what I love as a 17-year-old that is only accessible to me because of what the band program has provided for me.
Do you have a favorite performance that you've done?
Just recently, the Slow High Jazz Band played at the Cuesta Jazz Festival, which is super fun because we get clinicked on a performance from professionals from Stanford, Andy Martin, who's played for a ton of famous musicians and famous TV and movies. He plays trombone. He's been in the Family Guy. He played in the Family Guy intro, for example, and they got to give us tips and help us learn so much. That was just a super enriching experience for me.
And did you always know that you wanted to do jazz, or was that something you were exposed to early on and then really liked it?
I had no idea I wanted to do jazz until I joined the high school. I joined the class because it looked fun, and it's just been a journey since then of me discovering how much I love jazz.
In your own opinion, what is the importance of music education?
For me, as a student, I feel like there's two major aspects of music education that's important. There's the music, obviously, right? Being able to have these skills is just such a fun way. You know, for those of us who are super passionate about music, it's a great way to pursue our passion. And even if you're not passionate about music, it's a great skill to carry into life, you know, playing songs around a campfire or whatever, or just understanding music and being able to appreciate it more. And the second aspect is community. It's kind of an inside joke within a program, you know, that it's like a family, but it truly is for a lot of people, and it provides a lot of community for people who, like my mom mentioned, you know, need that. And I think that's super valuable. Honestly, just as valuable for many people as the music aspect of it.
Yeah. And then you get people who continue with music and then go back to the younger generation, like the jazz clinic that you went to. Is that something you're interested in the future for yourself, to continue with music?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm not sure if I'm going to study it, if I'm going to major in it in college, minor in music in college, or just play music throughout college. That's definitely still a mystery to me. You know, I know for a lot of people my age, what you're going to do after high school is a mystery. But I know with absolute certainty that I'm going to play music for the rest of my life.
It's such a great skill for all of these kids to have. I'm envious when I watch them get together, and especially because, you know, especially jazz, because it's so improvisational. But you really get the sense that these kids are having a great time together and communicating and forming bonds in a way that is only accessible to people who speak this common language.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas, and I'm Sam Doyle Jacobson with Kim and Wes Bishop, speaking about music education at SLO High School and Laguna Middle School. All right, so I want to use the second half of our interview to talk about your upcoming fundraiser, Beats and Brass. Can you tell me a little more about the details of that?
Sure. So Beats and Brass is going to be a great time. Those of us who worked on planning the event first and foremost wanted to make it a celebration, something that we would be excited to go to ourselves and invite our friends to. There's going to be great music. The headlining band is called the Funk Junket. And if you haven't seen them, they are just really high energy, fun. You can't listen to them and sit still. I mean, they're just a blast. It's going to be held at the absolutely gorgeous Riata Ranch up in Santa Margarita. We're really grateful for the sponsorship from Riata Ranch, also sponsorship by KCBX, and it's allowed us to keep our costs really low so that we can maximize the fun factor. DOM Jazz Combo is going to be opening, and they'll be playing jazz and funk before the main band comes on. We've got great food by Old Slow Barbecue, and there will be a silent auction as well. And tickets are available online at my805tix.com. You can search for Beats and Brass, or you can go to slowtigerband.org and find a link to the ticket site on our homepage.
I have to say, speaking as someone who came from Southern California, the local band scene on the Central Coast is certainly unique. And I know the Funk Junket is one of those local bands.
Yeah, it's been fun to watch them come into prominence. You know, they started playing here and there, and now everywhere I look, they're on the roster, and we feel really lucky that they were able to join us and willing to join us. They've also been really excited about bringing in some of the younger kids to play with them. So, you know, some of the high school students who are in DOM are going to sit in with them on a few songs, and it's just a really wonderful group of musicians, and they're very welcoming. In fact, the Barry Sax player in the Funk Junket went through the Slow High Band program when he was in high school, and a bunch of them are teachers or former teachers. So, yeah, it's a really welcoming crew.
The cycle of music kind of repeats itself.
That's right, yeah.
Is there anything, Wes, that you've learned through performing with DOM?
I mean, I've learned how to handle nerves, and I guess what I'd say is there isn't any specific thing I've learned about handling nerves, but through the experience of performing so much, I've just become a lot more, I don't know, I don't want to use the word seasoned, I'm 17, but a lot more used to performing in front of people. And that's a super important and useful thing that I've learned.
I would say, you know, I've watched the kids in the band develop me these professionalism skills, you know. I just how to communicate with adults by email and by phone, which, you know, I teach at Cal Poly, and that's something we have to teach our students often. You know, it's not something that is part of the skill set you grow up with these days. Learning how to stay accountable. When you say yes to a gig opportunity, you better be there. You have to know how to promote yourself. You have to know how to get photos and video clips when you perform. You have to know how to manage the money and keep all your bandmates accountable and schedule rehearsals. I mean, it's a lot. There are all of these business skills that come along with it that have been really fun to watch as they develop.
I've also needed to do a lot of collaborating. You know, building a set and making music with my bandmates is a very intensive and collaborative process. And sometimes there's disagreements. Sometimes it's hard to, you know, plan practices. And even the musical collaboration, you know, figuring out how we want things to sound is definitely a skill that can be applicable outside of music, too.
As much as music is an artistic pursuit, it's also a business pursuit to some extent, where you have to answer emails, you have to do scheduling, and it's also deeply interpersonal. Like, you have to be able to work and understand and listen to other people very closely.
Definitely. I think people who work in the arts often focus on the art and don't realize that developing the business piece of it is an entirely different skill set. So it's nice that they get to start that young.
Is DOM part of the school education program, or is it your own separate band that you formed?
So we're our own separate band that we made, but we are all members of the Slow High Honors Jazz Ensemble, and we formed from meeting each other through the Slow High Jazz program. So I was invited into the band by a member who's no longer in the band. He graduated last year. He's now in the Navy, but he got to see me play and the other younger members of our band play, and decided to make a band, invite us, and find opportunities to play around town because of the opportunities that we got through the school program.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, again, we really appreciate KCBX's support of the event, and you know, want to repeat that tickets are on sale, and you can find them at my805tix.com under Beats and Brass, or at slowtigerband.org.
And I'd like to reiterate, based on what I've seen from what Slow Wimba's been planning and what my band's been working on, this isn't just a fundraiser. We're collaborating to make this event something that, you know, people want to go to, even if it wasn't a fundraiser. There's going to be some really good music from the Funk Junket, and we're going to hopefully put something great together as well. We're going to have great food, drinks for those who can have them. And I think it's just going to be a super fun time, and I definitely recommend getting tickets.
Riata Ranch is a really special venue, too, and the owners have been so lovely in their support of music just in general. And we're excited to be there. I went there for the first time recently, and, you know, we were all just walking around this property with our jaws on the ground. Like, it was absolutely stunning. We can't believe we're lucky enough to be there. So, yeah, come join us. It's going to be fun.
Yeah. Definitely sounds like an event to look forward to. Kim and Wes, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Sam. Nice to talk with you.
Thanks so much.
This is Issues and Ideas. I'm Sam Doyle Jacobson, programming intern at KCBX. I've been speaking with Kim and Wes Bishop about Slow Wimba, a booster organization supporting the Slow High School and Laguna Middle School band programs, and Wes's jazz combo, DOM. Don't miss their upcoming Beats and Brass fundraiser featuring DOM and local funk band The Funk Junket. For more information, visit slowbandboosters.org.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Meher Ali. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today, or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.